Thanks for downloading the second episode of the Alt Animation Podcast, the podcast that talks about the saltier side of the animation industry. If you don't recognize the theme song, that is Firehouse 5 Plus 2, Sweet Georgia Brown. Firehouse 5 Plus 2 is a band of Disney animators, a Dixieland jazz band, popular in the 1950s. Definitely give them a listen, they're really cool. Ward Kimball, Frank Thomas, who you should know, played some great songs, and they played until the 70s, I think. Quite a few Disney animators played through it, so... Alright, well... This is the second episode of the Alt Animation Podcast. There was a great response for the first one. I think, other than Antarctica, there's been someone that's listened to the podcast on every continent, which is pretty sweet. I think that's pretty awesome. If you heard my mom, Robert's actually not here. It's only the second podcast, and he already is taking some vacation time, so... my mom is helping out. How's it going, Mom?
It's going great. Hi, everyone.
Are you excited to be here?
I'm excited to be here.
Today's podcast is an overall theme of women in animation. We got an interview with three very talented female animators. But first, I kind of want to go over some animation news and some interesting articles. So, Mom, did you even know that there's a Student Academy Award at all?
I had no clue.
Well, the guys who did South Park, they actually won one. Well, Trey Parker won one. But it really, is a great way for students to showcase their work and really talented students and kind of, get some recognition for it. But... the winners of this year's 2011 Student Academy Award is from Ringling College Computer Arts, the animation department. It's called Defective Detective, and it's really funny. Let's see the names here. Just says Mr. Geller and Miss Lewis. Oh, here we go. Avner Geller and Stevie Lewis. So definitely check that out. It's on the Ringling website. It's really funny. It's about a guy who is a detective, and he thinks that he knows where this murderer is, this mass murderer, and he goes into this old lady's house thinking she's getting murdered, but really she's just cooking food, and so he's, like, sneaking up on her. It's really funny. Alright, so, check that out. Oh, sorry, what were you going to say, Mom?
I was going to say, is it students who enter the competition or students who judge the competition?
No, it's students who enter, so you have to be a student to enter this, and then it's judged by the same, the Academy Awards.
People.
Yeah, so you get some notoriety. So moving on now, we're going to talk about the Casey Anthony trial. Have you heard about this trial at all? Do you even know what it's about? Well, this lady apparently is getting, or she was accused of killing her kid, her little baby, and they were saying because she wanted to party. It's a crazy case. But what we wanted to talk about is they use animation in court a lot. Especially for, like, accident reconstruction and things. It's a really cool industry. They make a lot of money, supposedly.
Okay.
But, what they do is they do 3D animations or whatever, kind of animations they use to recreate the accident and kind of use it as evidence. Well, they did something similar for this where they showed where the duct tape was going to go over her mouth. And it's a real gross case,
yeah.
But they used a animation of her face, of the little girl's face, and the mom is also in the picture, and a skull is superimposed over that, and then they put duct tape over it, like all in an animation to kind of show where everything was, and Geraldo Rivera, the guy with the mustache, he is saying, like, this is crazy, like, you can't have an animation of a skull going over somebody's face, like, that really, it kind of scares people, and it's you don't need it, really, but his whole argument is that, well, people are influenced by that, and the jurors are going to be influenced negatively, and he's saying it might even cause a mistrial. And it's hard to disagree with him because, an animation is supposed to invoke feelings, emotions, it's supposed to get you to be imaginative and, see things outside the box, see things that weren't already there, and kind of, help illustrate things. So it has a lot of power, especially in a courtroom, where there's jurors watching, and images have a very strong presence, especially in something like justice, where they're going to be using it to decide if someone's guilty or not. So,
right. Well, someone who's a visual learner, as soon as they see that, that helps them to see, oh, this is what could have and probably did happen.
It solidifies it in your mind,
absolutely, yeah.
And so, yeah, Geraldo Rivera saying, oh, it's going to cause a mistrial because you're not allowed to, put those kinds of ideas in people's minds if it's not the case. But the other people that are, on the other side of it saying, no, it's totally fine. They do this all the time with other, you know, other accident reconstruction and things like that.
So I was going to ask, is the first time that this has been used in a courtroom before?
Well, this is, you know, one of the more high-profile cases that it's been used, especially, you know, in recent times where it's becoming a lot easier and cheaper to make an animation. So, you know, who knows what the future is for animation in terms of courts and, like, mm-hmm. using it to persuade people. It's pretty interesting.
Well, and are they using it correctly? I mean, what if it's not true?
Well, I mean, why would you put a skull, superimpose it over, something that, it seems like it would be used for, like, if her skull was, you know, damaged in any way, or you know, there's, like, some kind of physical evidence with the skull.
With the skull.
But it's almost like it's like a, ooh, scary
yeah.
skull. But, you know, some people are saying, oh, it's not as bad as we thought it was, and some people are saying, oh, it's horrible. So definitely check that out. It's a very interesting case overall. I know a lot of people are following it, and animation is playing a big role in it, so
yeah.
definitely alternative. Next thing we're going to move on to, director Brad Bird. And now, we talked about this a little bit, but you know who Brad Bird is,
mm-hmm.
right? Director of Ratatouille,
right.
The Incredibles, Iron Giant. Really awesome dude, very, like, outspoken, cool guy.
Right.
Does a lot of, you know, really cool interviews and talks about animation in a very passionate way. Everybody knows who he is
mm-hmm.
in animation. Well, he is directing the next Mission Impossible movie, which you're a fan of the Mission Impossible movie.
I am a fan of Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I think they're cool, definitely. And it's really exciting to see where he's going to take it because he's such a fun, like, you know, he's got a great vision. To do an animated movie, you have to know exactly what you want. You have all the options, especially for The Incredibles. He talks about it, you know, like, hey, you know, well, they give him the option for hair, for clothes, for color. He has to decide. You're recreating an entire world.
Wow.
So he made the decision to recreate this entire world. Like, so it's interesting to see how he's going to do with live action when, you know, you have, you know, your people look like how they look.
Uh-huh.
You know, Tom Cruise is not going to look different.
No.
Although in Mission Impossible, they do switch their faces
a
lot.
They
so
do
yeah, maybe that'll be the easy part for him.
So is it the... Everything that's in the movie, the, you know, the scenes, the background, all that's going to all be animated, or?
No, it's going to be like a regular Mission Impossible movie.
There's just his brains? I mean, his ideas, his creativity?
Yeah, well, he's directing it, so he's moving from animation
to,
and it's pretty interesting to think because, all right, so he started off doing 2D, and that's his whole thing. He was at Disney for a while, and then, you know, that kind of fell out with him. Well, then he moved on to computer animation. He talks about how it was such a big jump for him because, you know, it's totally different how it works. But it's almost like a middle step from 2D to live action.
Right.
So who knows if he would have gotten to live action if it wasn't for 3D. But
is that what he always wanted to do? Did he say he always wanted to be live action?
He actually mentions that he just loves movies. Like,
okay.
And animation is great because it gives you the opportunity to tell any kind of crazy story.
Absolutely.
So if you're a more creative person, animation is kind of like the way to go because you have a lot of, you know, options.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like taking those options back,
right.
But in a way, it's I'm sure it's a lot different and then probably a lot better in some ways where you don't have to wait 2 years for everything to get built before you see anything.
That's
you can
true.
Just go on set and shoot. I'm sure it's a lot more interesting and fun. And, like, they're shooting on the Burj, which is the newest building that they built in India. It's the tallest building. It's huge, like, gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
And they're shooting on that, and Tom Cruise is, like, flying down, doing stunt work all over it.
Yeah.
So it's totally different, because you're actually in the field, like, shooting.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really interested to see this movie and how it works. So I bet it's going to be really cool. And I love everything that Brad Bird does. I think he's a genius. So we should go see that together.
That would be good. Yeah, I'd like to.
Yeah, let's go see that. All right. Next thing coming up, performance capture. A lot of people are talking, or this one guy in particular, there's a big hubbub about the Academy Award and, like, what constitutes an animated film, because they have all these ones that are motion capture, you know, where they put on the suits and they
mm-hmm.
have little pinballs
mm-hmm.
on them.
Right.
Yeah, so...
Just like that Green Lantern? Oh.
Green Lantern?
Yes.
Yes, yeah, exactly like that. That's how they did his suit. So there's a big thing about, oh, well, is that animation? Because you don't actually have a guy going in and keying it.
Mm-hmm.
But in some cases you do, because you have a guy going in and cleaning it up and kind of plussing their performance and making it better. So it's a big, weird thing, and there's some movies that have live action and animation in them, so the Academy's trying to catch up and, like, keep up with their categories
mm-hmm.
because technology's changing things so fast. Well, there's another guy, an animation producer, says that performance capture isn't true animation. And, you know, they're saying, no, sorry, like, Mars Needs Moms, The Polar Express, you know, it's kind of like feels real, but it's sort of creepy.
Right,
you know?
Right, yes.
Well, they're making a new movie. Steven Spielberg is doing Tintin, which is an old French comic book and an old cartoon. I don't know if you remember me watching that old cartoon.
Mm-hmm, I remember.
Yeah. Well, you know, basically what they're saying is, okay, this... And Steven Spielberg is obviously going to want his movie considered for the Academy Awards. And
sure.
You know, with the animation category, it's a little bit easier to get in because there's less films.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of hoping that his movie will get nominated for the animated category, but everyone else is kind of pushing back saying no because it is performance capture. It's
right.
Recorded that
right.
way.
Right, okay.
So it's really interesting to see how this all plays out, you know, and how everything works out for him because, you know, in a way I do agree with both sides because one, you know, one's more artistic. You have people thinking about it and you know, sitting down and planning things out and really being artistic and using animation in a way that traditionally how it's been used.
Right.
But on the other side, you know, how much of animation is really like somebody being creative and not, you know, just using reference or using images of somebody else. All right, moving on. Oh, and talking about performance capture, there's a new game called L.A. Noir, which is really cool. You play a detective in the 50s,
uh-huh.
and you have to read people's facial expressions, guess if they're lying, uh-huh. and they use this new technology that records faces that is almost dead on. Like, when
wow.
you squint your eyes, you can't tell that you're seeing, you know, an actual, you know, it looks like a person.
Wow.
And as an animator, it's pretty cool because, you know, you study all these things like, oh, if someone looks up to the left or looks to the right, what that means, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, someone kind of, you know, looks around, and especially as a mom, you probably have an innate way to tell if somebody's lying.
I usually can.
Yeah. I bet you would really like this game.
You.
Well, yeah, you've caught me quite a few times. But the game is really cool, and, you know, as an animator, it almost makes it funner to play, but on the other end, it's kind of scary because this is some really good facial animation that would take a long time to get this kind of nuance as with traditional animation.
Yeah.
So it's like kind of scary because it's like, oh, you know, how much of, you know, for future projects, how much are you going to need an animator unless it's cartoony or exaggerated? So we'll see how that works out.
It seems to me like technology is going to do away or is doing away with the skill of an animator because the computer, you know, especially with all those little, you know, things you put on the bodies and every movement you make can dictate, you know, what it looks like on the screen. It seems like then anybody, as long as they learn the technology, can do that as opposed to being creative. I said, because you still have to be creative.
Well, you're giving them performance no matter what. So if, you know, you're an animator, you're giving an acting performance. So really it's all about,
true.
You know, the story is the most important. It's not about the actual animation. I mean, some projects are, oh, wow, the animation is beautiful, and they're kind of known for that. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of freaky, you know, you don't know where things are going to go and how things are going to end up, you know.
The future.
Yeah, exactly, in the future of animation. But I'm sure, you know, like back in the Disney times, they would draw over live action.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so a lot of people were afraid, oh, you know, everything's going to end up that way. It's called rotoscoping. Well, you know, it moved on. I think there's always going to be a need for a really talented animator. It just might not be as many jobs as it is right now, especially for games. So.
Well, maybe more and more actors and actresses are worried about animation or technology because if they can make a person look real on the screen that's not really there, that's cheaper than paying an actor $1 million, you know.
Yeah, like if you see the new Tron, they use Jeff Bridges as a young Jeff Bridges. You know, it still doesn't look exactly like him, but it's getting really close.
Oh, really? So
they actually recreated Marlon Brando for the new Superman movie too. So it's like you can almost like, if you're,
oh,
you know, if you're a good actor, you can act for years
forever,
and years after
and
you're dead.
Pay you.
Exactly. So
pay your...
it's really interesting to see how this all comes out. Sorry, what were you gonna say?
No, yeah.
Well, okay, let's just move on to the main topic: women in animation. So, kind of controversial. A lot of, you know, there's a lot of news about it. The new Pixar movie coming out, Brave. The director got cut, and she was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It happens all the time, but it's been a big deal because it is a woman and, you know, it was the first one, so people are talking about it a little bit more. In the Kung Fu Panda 2, which you saw the other
mm-hmm.
day, Jennifer Yu Nelson, she was the director for it, and, you know, that kind of brought up women in directorial areas, and like, they changed the name of Tangled to, or sorry, they changed the name of Rapunzel to Tangled to try to, like, get more boys interested, you know, because all the Disney princesses, they kind of have the stigma that, oh, only girls like that. So it's a big deal right now, and, you know, a lot of people are talking about it, and a lot of people feel like you shouldn't talk about it because it kind of singles out women as saying, no, they're not animators, you know. So one thing I posted up on a CG Talk, I posted up the first episode of the podcast, and I asked, you know, for the next episode, hey, you know, if anyone has any, you know, interesting things about female animators, you know, let me know. Well, this one lady, Leigh Vanderbilt, she is a CG Society staff member, very talented artist. She has worked on some great projects, a very well-respected member of the CG community. She originally wrote an article called From Pots to Polygons, or Pots and Pans to Polygons, and this was back in, I think, 2003 that she wrote this. Really interesting article about, you know, highlighting some of the female animators or artists in general in CG. And, you know, kind of expressing some opinions about it, and overall you get that, well, things aren't really that bad, you know, it's not like women are treated horribly in the workplace, but there's just not enough of them. Mm-hmm. And so I posted this up, and she responded to one of my posts about it, you know, quite a few years later, saying she's kind of changed her mind about it. Now she doesn't necessarily think that singling out and focusing on women is a good thing. And that, it, let's see what she says here. When you say female animators, you're insinuating that there's something different about them, even mm-hmm. though you're not necessarily doing it in a malicious or negative fashion. And it kind of made me second guess doing this topic because, you know, I'm not a pro on it. I don't know everything about it, but I kind of want to focus this, you know, this podcast on talking about things that are kind of, you know, iffy or controversial in a way. So I figured might as well get an interview in, and that's, you know, the three very talented female animators. We talked to them about this. So give it a listen, and if you guys have any comments, definitely feel free to email me at altanimation@gmail.com. And are you excited about the interview, Mom?
I'm very excited.
All right, well, we'll be back after the interview to wrap it up. Okay, well, let's just start off by doing a roll call, a lady roll call. Your name?
Melissa Nivelt-Sost.
And about how long have you been working in the animation industry now?
Almost about 4 years. 4 years this summer.
All right, and any particular, like, reason why you got into it? Any cool, like, origin stories?
Well, I started off about 4 or 5 years ago. I was on the East Coast, and I wanted to do animation, but at the time, there wasn't a lot to do. So I was like, well, my big dream and everyone else's dream on the East Coast is to go to California. So I started just packed up my car and just drove out there, hoping to go to school at the Academy of Art, and needed work at the time. My brother is in the industry of gaming, and I was hoping to get into film. And he's like, well, we need an intern. So I sort of just was like, okay, it's a paid internship, that's good. So I went there, and they sort of really liked me and hired me on, and I was there for almost 3.5 years, I guess.
And can you say the name of the company?
Yeah, Ready at Dawn Studios.
Cool. I did not know that, actually, about you. And what part of the East Coast were you from?
Connecticut.
Connecticut. Big change, huh?
Oh, yeah.
All right. And next, Harley. Well, I guess, I'll let you say your name.
Oh, yes. Harley Dvorts is my full name. I got into animation because, well, I loved animation. I always loved it. Huge Disney fan, all that good stuff. When it came time to graduate from high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, but the Art Institute seemed to be more readily accepting of students than some of the state schools at the time. So I was like, I'll check it out, do animation. I went through the whole program. It was a pretty general program, but I wanted to focus on animation, and I had an opportunity, like Melissa, to become an animation intern because some people I knew had gotten a job at Obsidian Entertainment. So I interned there doing mocap, learned a lot about what I didn't know. So once my internship was up there, I went on to Animation Mentor to solidify my understanding of animation, and now I'm working at Edge of Reality.
Very cool.
It's working out.
Awesome. All right, and Paula, or I keep on saying you guys' name. Go ahead.
This is Paula Decanini. I think I was always, like, really, really into animation. I liked animation a lot more than, like, live-action movies and TV shows. And probably, like, biggest influence, like, the thing that had the biggest influence on me was, like, The Lion King. Because I, like, no exaggeration, I sat one summer and just watched that movie every day. and just, like, studied it. Just, like, really, really watched it and studied it. I wasn't sure that animation was what I wanted to go into. I wanted to do something with art. But animation just was the thing that kind of kept coming back. I kept coming back to. So I went to the University of Louisville in Kentucky for got a fine arts degree. And then after that, I think is when I decided, okay, I'm going to go for animation. So I went to Vancouver, studied animation up there at Vancouver Institute of Media Arts. And I've been doing it for coming on like 3 years this fall.
Very cool. Well, yeah. I would like to just tell all of you guys that I think you all are amazing animators. Very cool. Like, I don't know, it's really interesting because, like, you know, there's three of you here, and that's way more than the average, you know, of percentages of women in the animation industry. So definitely feel very lucky that you guys are all here. It's very cool stuff. But, you know, the last podcast we kind of touched on, like, Brenda Chapman getting cut from Pixar, and then Jennifer Nelson doing the Kung Fu Panda 2 and directing it, you know, just a lot of people are talking about it. You know, they're discussing how Pixar, you know, they changed the name of Rapunzel to Tangled to try to make it more of a wider audience for boys, and just, you know, it's in the news a lot, and so I figured it'd be cool to get you guys together and talk about it a little bit and get your opinions on things. I mean, do you guys, have you ever, like, experienced any issues with being a woman? Let's do left to right.
Okay, right. Me? Yeah. Well, touching on the Pixar thing, it should also be pointed out, this is, that movie Brave is, like, the first movie where they had a female protagonist. And like, I read in an interview with the, what is her name, Brenda? And
you guys can definitely feel free to jump in if you know, have any opinions on anything.
Oh, I can't find her name.
Brenda Chapman.
She worked on that for, like, 6 years. That was, like, a labor of love for her. And then she was, like, inspired by her daughter to make this movie about a princess who, you know, isn't, like, the typical Disney princess where she sits around and waits for Prince Charming to save the day, you know? And, yeah.
Would you guys find that that's most of the movies that are geared towards girls nowadays, or at least in the past, is...
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think that there's... They make this distinction between girl themes and boy themes, and not universal themes. Well, I don't know. Maybe they tend to think that boy themes are universal, but girl themes are more, like, specialized. And they really... That's where, like, they only really tackle what they would consider girl themes if they're specifically targeting girls.
Well, when you guys were watching, you know, the old Disney movies, you know, Little Mermaid or Snow White or whatever, were you guys watching it thinking, oh, this is a girl movie, and, like, I'm watching, you know, I'm getting a lot of girl role model, you know, information in or anything like that?
Not necessarily.
I'd say the story, I think the characters, if you ask guys now, they're like, oh, Ariel's pretty hot. Like, you're going to get the very, like, sexual part of the character to the male, but as far as the story and the Prince Charming and the whatever, that's definitely, like, little girl's dream. You know, they have all the big Disney weddings because of that. You dress up as, like, Cinderella and stuff, and that's very feminine, like, pointed to.
Yeah,
and that's still going on, like, Disneyland, and Disney definitely promotes the little princess, but that's
like a huge marketing thing.
They're making billions of dollars.
Yeah. Oh, you just see the guys dressing up with the princess, or like the prince, and like running around. It's always the girls and the.
Like in some of those movies, the prince is like completely anonymous too. We don't even learn what his name is. Like he's just this generic male figure who comes in and red saves the day. You know.
Yeah, they're almost stereotypical.
They're very just your basic. Charming prince. Yeah. He fits, like, that
stereotype, and that's all he has to do.
I've never thought about that, that, yeah, the men were almost made objects, I guess, in terms of, like, a woman thinking about it. Yeah.
To reward the woman for, in the case of Cinderella, for keeping her head down, working hard, and all this other stuff, doing what a good woman is supposed to do, I guess.
So how do you think that affected your guys' like, not psyche as women, because I'm sure there's a whole, like, research on, tons of research on all that, as animators, I mean, like, do you guys feel like approaching a shot, you have to do it in a more feminine way, or do you think there's any pressure on you, like, getting certain characters and certain things?
I think a little bit. I mean,
I think it has a lot to do. Like, as a child growing up, you're just so used to that way, like, you just assume that's how it is. But as an adult and, like, watching the old, like, Disney behind-the-scenes type stuff with the 9 old men, especially since it was, like, all men, you know, just the character of Betty Bop and Ariel and all those other characters, like, they really made it more out for, like, the men. So the men are drawing them all day, so they want them to be, like close and attractive or bonded to their character, so they're not going to make some ugly thing. And one thing that our lead always talks about is one thing he likes about an animated film is, you know, the good female character. Is she good-looking or not? That's, to him, that makes a good film, and I thought that was a little sad, but, you know, that's his opinion.
Well, we went to see that movie we just all went to go see at the Alamo.
We've seen a lot.
ILM.
Rango?
Rango, yeah. Yes. Our lead didn't like the female character because she had no appeal as a female. Well, she was interesting, but, like,
he was thrown off by the whole movie because of it. I was like, that's sad, because there's just so much good aspects of that movie that you just sort of overlooked because of the female character.
And yeah, she had a lot of character to her. I mean, the whole, like, freezing up when you get nervous kind of thing, you know, transcends to everybody, not just girls. But
if you look back just a little bit to a movie like El Dorado, the female character had a beautiful figure, but it was much fuller than any female character I think had been to date as a female. Mm-hmm. Because she had big hips and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was actually, people made a point of that. Like, oh, she was full figure, you know, showing that, like, it's okay. But, like, even she had, like, a ridiculously attractive figure. I mean,
or, like, you know, the girl in Hercules, I can't remember her name, but they made a big deal about how, you know, she was super skinny in the waist and, you know, big hips. And it was, they were designing it for, you know, after, like, a Roman sculpture or Roman pillar.
Yeah.
But, you know, people just, they freak out because, you know, so let's talk about that. I mean, do you guys think that there's almost kind of like a, I don't know, a backwards way of looking at it now, so much so that people feel like women have been objection, you know,
good about anime. But I mean, then, right there, that is like the ultimate boy's dream right there.
Yeah.
I mean, they project the way that girls should be.
Sailor Moon.
But men, too. Men are presented, all the male characters in these films are extremely muscular and handsome, and especially I think now male characters are, what's more interesting now is, like, the underdog. Like, look at How to Train Your Dragon. Like, mm-hmm, you know, the geeks can become, you know, you're going to be cool because of your brain, and yet they still meet the hot chick.
Yeah.
But that, yeah.
I don't know.
But then there's movies like Howl's Moving Castle, where the main protagonist becomes an old, ugly woman, but, you know, we're still rooting for her. And I always like movies. I mean, it's so rare that it's always the young, pretty girl. If there is a female protagonist, she's young and she's pretty. I really like movies like Howl's Moving Castle or Triplets of Belleville, where the protagonist is, like, this old woman.
Yeah.
Who,
because usually
it's such a break. It's so, yeah, it's not what you're used to seeing, and then it's, I don't know, it's more interesting to me that way to see how an old woman reacts to, you know, dangerous situations.
Usually the fairy godmother character, and they're just there to help out, and they're never, you know, they don't focus on
them. Or the evil stepmother, evil hag who's trying to punish the young beauty.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, didn't you say that there was an article that you had read about the pay? We can talk about the pay a little bit.
Okay.
And I guess we'll talk about, like, work environment. I mean, you know, just, I don't know. I don't, obviously, you guys don't deal with that here, and, you know, even if you did,
Wouldn't want to say
this
anything.
Is probably the first studio where there's been over, like, two females.
There's a large amount of females in the studio, more than I've ever seen. But I hear that number is going up everywhere.
Well, in the game industry. In the film industry, there seems to be... That's where all the females tend to go in the game industry.
True.
Not so much. I mean, it's very rare that you see a lot of females.
I think just as almost... I mean, I don't necessarily want to say this. I'm going to say this anyway, though, but because women in the game industry is so new and being a woman, like, on the verge of more women being in the industry, it's almost... It can work in your advantage if you are as good or if you can compete with the level of work as everyone else. It's like, I think some teams want to have more different types of people. I mean,
different viewpoints.
Do you feel a pressure to work harder to, like, try and fend off the stigma?
If you have, like, a younger team that's been there, they're not going to care. If you have a team that's been, like, seniority-wise, 10-plus years, they're not going to look at you the same, and I've experienced that before.
Yeah,
Even if you're just a young male coming in, they'll give you crap here and there, but they have a little more respect for you than a young female. I've noticed that a lot, which is sort of sad.
That's true, and at the same time, if you are working in a team, I mean, if you're working with people who have experience, there's a certain amount of launch, you're not going to be as good as they are. They have years and years on you. But if you come in with a team of a bunch of young men, and your work is clearly not as good as theirs, that's twice the blow, because you're saying, as a woman, I'm not keeping up. So, I mean, I don't think that's the case. I don't think people would be getting the job if they didn't have, you know, what it takes.
But. Well, yeah, I mean, even if the pressure isn't there from other people for you guys to do better, it's almost like, you know, in your own minds, like, you kind of feel like you have to prove yourself more than, say, like a dude would imagine.
Well, it kind of, for me, it always bothers me if, like, people refer to someone as a woman animator or a woman artist. Just call them an artist. I know. Just call them an artist. Just call them an animator. I mean, it's not like there's like anything different that's being done.
It's true,
yeah.
But
animation-wise, yeah.
It's also just a reality of things.
Mm-hmm.
Like
they see you.
We would be having this podcast.
Yeah,
it wasn't
exactly.
Like. But no, I totally agree with you.
I think the cool thing about it, yeah, is that you guys have to, you know, and to a certain extent, no, I mean, you're just treated equally in a lot of ways, but to a certain extent, you do have to work harder, and you do have to kind of fight stigma, so that, you know, I think in a way, it does kind of separate you, you know, girls, almost in a good way, you know, that you work harder, you're more dedicated, you know, and at least with you guys, I've noticed that, you know, at all the studios I worked at, all the women were highly dedicated, so.
But I think it's not... I think it's all coming from the men in the workplace. It's their point of view that women are different. I don't think that we think of ourselves as being different in the workplace. I think it's...
Yeah, we can have just as much passion
and
hard days and good days and bad days like any other one. It's just all amount of what the work... It should be all what your work is at the end.
And
it doesn't matter what your race or color or it is or whatever. Whatever you can produce, that's what they should be looking at.
And animation is so unique because your work is expressing yourself through a character. So, you know, like, you can almost embody whatever character you are.
That's
another
good point to bring up because the last studio I was at, I was always told when working with a female character, if I had the opportunity to do that, which most female characters actually went to all the male animators. But if I did get that chance, I was always told how she should act, what she should look like. I'm like, really? I think I may understand that. But they have this idea in their head of what a female character, how she should move, present herself, just the overall character of her. And it would be nothing that I would see, but because it's a male portraying in their head what they're
looking for. A caricature.
Yeah. It was very, very different. And I was always, and actually I had one character taken away because I wasn't making her feminine enough.
In their opinion,
yeah.
Oh.
It was very interesting, and I was sort of blown away and shocked. I was like, wow.
That's
crazy.
Last job I worked at, I was working on a female character. My main direction for animating this character was make her sexy. That was it. That was, like, the main direction.
So
just make her sexy.
Did a little part of you die when you heard that?
No, because I was like, you know what, I'm going to just go ahead and animate her the way I think that she should be animated, and if I do a good job, then they're not going to say, no, that's not sexy enough. But there was one shot I remember, I, like, really hammed it up. She was, like, bending over the table, and, like, her ass was all hanging out. And, like, I showed it to someone, and they were like, okay, I know that was the direction you were given, but tone it down a little bit.
So you just did it kind of show them, like, hey, here's how dumb you are.
Yeah.
You know what, though? On the other hand, I probably don't help the stereotype, because if I was given the character and they were like, make her sexy, I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm going to make her sexy. Like, I'd probably have fun with that. And yeah. I would never question it or have a problem with it. Like, I'm so used to, like, what, like, the audience thinks they want, or what we want the audience to want, that, like, I feel like I need to be a part of just whatever.
I think that's just society alone.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, if we were to actually try to be sexy ourselves, if we didn't have to press any guys, like, our view of sexy would be very, very different from what you would find.
Yeah.
Because you would be more for attractiveness and we'd be more for how we feel. But, and it's not that there's a problem with animating them to the way they should be sexy. It's just, it's funny how they portray, like, a certain thing, and they almost feel like we women don't know what sexy is, or should be. It's like, like, no, we get what you want.
Oh, what were you found the,
Well, this is printed in
2009.
This is from Game Developer Magazine. They have some numbers about women in the gaming industry specifically. Their survey showed 9%. Women make up 9% of the total workforce. But the...
And this is strictly games, right?
Yeah, this is just games. And then IGDA, they have a different number. It's 12%. They say, on average, it's about... Women make about $11,000 less.
That's crazy.
Specifically, artists and animators... It's about, like, 9% or 9,000 less. So.
That's just sad, because I know in the game industry, animators are already on the lowest of the totem pole.
Yeah. In the,
are we compared to other artists? Yeah. I thought animators had the opportunity to make more money than, say, environment artists.
In the game industry, I think it's a little bit different than, like, yeah, like a feature length.
Yeah.
I think animators are more prized in the film industry.
Yeah, because they're like the ones who are really, they're the workhorses of the whole film.
Because it's such an awesome job. And
generally,
you know, like,
the more of a workhorse you are, the less you get paid. I don't know how to work with.
Yeah.
But the whole film kind of, like, it's more dependent on animation, whereas games, you
it's
can
environment
spend.
And programming. Like, without those two, you definitely would be screwed.
So do you guys feel like the, you know, the money issue, I mean, does that directly reflects how a company values you, is how much they pay you, or I mean, do you think
that's
something
pretty
to
pretty standard in any industry?
Going to the medical industry,
women on average, get paid about 10% less than men. And there was, like, a study a few years ago done by Carnegie Mellon Institute, and they think they found the reason why this is. And they, I mean, there's been all kinds of theories, but they noticed. During the interview process, it didn't matter who was hiring the employee, if it was a male or a female manager. If a man was presented with a figure for a salary and he asked for more, they would either say yes or no, but they wouldn't think differently of him. If a woman asked for more money, they would look at her differently. She would be seen as pushy or not nice.
Bossy, yeah.
And that might affect... if whether or not she actually got hired. So they think that it's just a thing that women, they don't, it's not that women can't negotiate or are too timid to negotiate for more money, it's just that we kind of know, you know, if we ask for more money, they're going to look at us differently.
That's crazy, yeah, I had no idea. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, we're, okay, talking about the industry for women,
mm-hmm.
You are pregnant, Melissa. So, is that how does that affect
you
your animation?
Nice. Yes.
How does that affect you? I mean, I could only imagine, like, first of all, how crazy it is to be pregnant, period. But just, like, you know, overall, you know, in your animation, like, how does it affect how you work? I mean, Do you have to sit farther away from the desk?
Nowadays, I do. My chair is not low enough for my desk. But that was one thing I always worried about getting into. Well, not knowing I was ever going to be in game, but just film industry. Like, how do you raise a family? Because seeing how a majority of them are male and there's a lot of dads, they take like 1 or 2 weeks off, they're fine, they come back to work, and then mommy and baby stay home. Well, I don't want to stay home. I mean, I want to stay home with my baby, but I don't want to, like, be the stay-at-home mom. I want to continue my career because I've worked so hard at it. So that was always a big thing that my husband and I talked about. Like, well, what do? We want to start a family, but me and him are both in the game industry, so it's like, okay, well, what do? He's like, well, you could stay home, and I was like, no, I really want to come back to work. I'm going to get cabin fever with a screaming baby next to me. I might go crazy. But, yeah. So, yeah, when I found out I was pregnant, I was all excited, but at the same time, I was really, really nervous about my job. And if I had to leave, would I be able to come back? If I ever did want to get into the film industry, just the hours alone would just, I would never be able to see my family. And then seeing how my husband's in the industry as well, he has the same crazy hours. So it's been a little difficult, but we're just taking this day by day. And so far, Edgy Reality has been just really great as far as the pregnancy thing. But yeah, working before I was pregnant, I had so much energy. I could stay here all night, like, no big deal. My mind was, like, focused. Now I'm just, like, off in my land. I can't remember what I did 5 minutes ago. I got baby brain, and I'm tired all the time. I just want to sleep, or I don't feel good. I'm just sit at my desk, and I'm like, is it nap time yet?
I have no idea how you do it, man, honestly. It's pretty awesome. So.
But you're still getting all your work done and meeting your deadlines despite these, like...
I am. I don't know how, but I am. Surprisingly. But I don't feel as effective as I used to be. Like, before, I could just look at a shot and be like, okay, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm just like, okay, so if we do this, oh, I don't know, and that's... Yeah, it's very, very different, and I hope I can get that back once after the baby.
Well, I don't know that much about, you know, pregnancy in general, but I mean, your whole physical body changes, and your mental, you know, all your chemicals are firing at. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine.
Baby's not in here yet, and I'm getting back asleep.
That's crazy. Well, yeah, definitely very impressive that you managed to go through all that and still, you know, do such a great job, but kind of leads in, you're talking about a thing that my girlfriend actually wanted me to ask you guys is, how does the industry, because obviously a lot of hours, possibility of moving everywhere.
Job uncertainty.
Yeah, job uncertainty. You know, you go only a couple months working a job. How does that affect relationships? I mean,
ever since I got into the artistic field, from the minute that I entered even art school, I have not dated, except for one, maybe one person significantly, I haven't dated anyone but other artists. So it's to the point where when I do talk to people who aren't in the industry, or guys, it can be frustrating sometimes. It's like, how do you not know what I'm talking about? I mean, as a rule, the people I date are, like, incredibly computer savvy, very aware of the hours, very understanding of, like, I can't, I have homework, or I can't, I have to stay late. Like, there is no argument there. However, I did date one person who had absolutely no concept of this, thought he already knew everything about it because he played games, and was just utterly frustrating to be around this person because he had absolutely no respect for what goes into producing a game as opposed to playing it and reading about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that did not work out.
Yeah, well, good. He sounds like a jerk.
Baby. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Because I've dated artist types myself, so I've never tried to date, like, someone who just had, like, a regular, like, 9-to-5 job. I think dating someone who's in the industry, too, which I'm doing now, makes it a lot easier so that when you tell them, hey, we're doing overtime all this, like, month, they're like, oh, yeah, well, I know. And if you tell them, hey, I got a job offer in another city, I mean, that's something you have to work out, but they understand you got to go where the jobs are. They're not going to get, like, terribly angry and upset about it, and but, yeah, I wouldn't know what it's like to date outside the industry, but...
I haven't. It is frustrating. Like, they don't understand overtime, and when I eventually met my husband, he had just finished his crunch. I had just finished mine. We hadn't, like, seen the outside for, like, over a year. Mm-hmm. So it's, we understand, like, what it's like to sit in a small office, you know, 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's just, so we can understand, although it does suck because while he was on crunch, I wasn't on crunch, and then I would go on crunch, and he'd get off crunch. So
yeah.
It can get difficult that way, where you don't necessarily see each other, unless you work in the same building.
And it's, I imagine it can be hard, too, if, like, someone doesn't appreciate the amount of, like, training you have to go into just to get into this industry, all the amount of, like, work you have to put into it, just, like, building basic skills like drawing and stuff like that, to just animating and doing tutorials and learning programs, because you have to do that just to, like, keep up, because the, you know, because the technology is always changing, and, you know, someone who just goes to work, comes home, and then does whatever they want with their leisure time, I don't think really understands, like, for, like, artists and animators, you go to work, you come home, but you might continue working on projects. You know, you'll be working when you come home.
Yeah, it's, I just realized that if I were interviewing three dudes right now, I wouldn't have asked them about dating, but I think it's, you know.
I think guys have a lot of issues with girlfriends who are like, why can't you hang out with me? Especially, I've seen a lot of male artists who are frustrated with their girlfriends because they simply want more time, like, they are not understanding. But that sacrifice is your career, which is, that's what it is to be an artist. It's to give up everything and to put everything on the line so that you can do something that you'd like to do with your time.
Yeah, I've seen marriages and relationships end because of that, which is sort of sad. But you think that going into it, they would have a better understanding. Not necessarily knowing everything, but hey, you know, this is my life. This is what I have to do. But it's still can be difficult. And, yeah.
Well, and occasionally you get those times where your crunch time isn't the same, or it is the same as somebody else's, and then you have that time to, like, really spend together and, like, don't have anything going at that time.
And
you don't have a job.
Together.
Yeah, yeah. You really have to depend on each other.
Me and my boyfriend, we're unemployed for the last almost a year. I mean, I had an odd job or two, and he was in between jobs. We had some time to get to know each other, and he actually, I was having a really hard time finding work in California. I was also trying to finish school, and I was intimidated by the industry out there, because, I mean, the competition is a lot heavier, because there's such a larger number of artists looking for work in California. He found work in Texas, and I knew that there was work out here, so I decided to follow him out here and hope, you know, take my chances. I got extremely lucky to find this, which has given me the opportunity to produce more work and, you know, practice, and I feel like I'll be much more ready for the next thing that comes after this. But when I did follow him out here, it was like we had this big going away party, and most people knew that I went to school for animation and had an internship, but I still wasn't in the industry. And it was like, it's Zach's going away party because he's got a job, and it's like, and Harley's going with him. And it was sort of like, okay, I'm following him because he got a job. But I was, like, able to change all that when I got out here.
But you know what?
That's crazy.
If you do, like, move as a couple, it does kind of make things easier, because then you two can, like, pool your resources.
This is true.
Contacts, yeah.
And then you can look for jobs together, you can pull your money together and not have to just buy a one-bedroom apartment you have to pay for by yourself, but you're with somebody else.
Right.
Yeah.
What about, like, competition? I mean, I don't date somebody that's in the industry. I would imagine, like, someone made my significant other made something better than me, I'd be competitive.
It can get, you have to keep your head straight, because this has happened to me. When you both apply for the same job, and then one of you gets it, and then the other person's like, you know?
Yeah.
But
why do they like you better than me?
Yeah, you got to just remember, there could be any number of reasons why someone got hired and someone didn't, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything, and
they didn't want to hire a girl.
Yeah. But you just got to remind yourself, hey, you know, if you're a couple and you're a strong couple, what's good for the other person is also good for me, and just be happy for them.
It seems like animators and artists tend to have that kind of the quality that you observe stuff and kind of have a bigger, you know, awareness of how things work and kind of a bigger picture, so it's easier to kind of take yourself out of stuff, I think.
But I think it's nice being in the industry, especially if you're not the same studio, because then it gives you an opportunity to meet people from other studios as well.
Yeah.
So totally. Now you know people from two different studios, and you get a lot more context that way. It's all about networking.
Yeah, it's all a lot of work.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, mainly the podcast is usually about, you know, just alternative animation, because most of the podcasts that are out there, you know...
Well, go ahead. I know that. And so I did some research for you.
Wow. I need to interview women more often. Women are way better than that.
Well, I'm just a nerd. And,
you look bad, Paul.
I'm just a nerd, that's all. But there was a quote that I found. This is from Linda Szymanski. She works at the Cartoon Network. She's the vice president of original animation.
Oh, crazy.
And this is what she had to say. She had to say, women pursuing careers in the field seem more interested than men in animation as an art form. Thus, it is not surprising that the area of independent filmmaking seems to have more women than men. After all, it is an area of animation which has more room for self-expression and no real traditional hierarchy in which to fit. I think we've been talking a lot about, like, animation as entertainment, but, I mean, there is this whole, like, independent animation as art scene, and... When you talk about, like, women in entertainment, I mean, women have always been in animation, and I got some historical notes for you. One of the first full-length animated films in 1925 was The Adventure of Prince Ahmed by a German woman named, I think this is her name, Lottie Renegar.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
And 1951... there was a woman named Mary Ellen Bute. She created the first, she was the first American to make an abstract film. It's called Color Rhapsody.
Crazy.
Did I say 1951? Yeah. And she was also the first filmmaker, animated filmmaker, to use electronically generated images.
That is awesome.
So
is
long awesome. Before John Lasseter came along, this woman was doing that.
That is so cool.
And yeah, and like even in back in the days of Disney, like the entire paint department, that was all women.
It was
you know?
So the paint department. Yeah,
yeah.
The first department that they cut whenever they
when they started going.
Yeah.
And one of the big concept artists at Disney was Mary Blair, who worked on Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan,
amazing
Cinderella.
Artist. Man. Her stuff is so good.
Yeah, I mean it's influence. Like, her influence in movies like The Incredibles, that kind of, like, 60s, bright colors, you know, style. I think with the entertainment industry, where there's a lot of money involved, I mean, there's the issue... I mean, women have always been in there, but they've not been in positions where they really get creative control. But when you look at, like, independent filmmaking... like, I lived in Canada for, like, a year, and in Canada they have this thing called the Canadian Film Board, where the government just gives independent filmmakers money just to make whatever they want. And
cool.
Yeah, it's really cool, and it's just for their own cultural heritage of Canada. So there's a lot of animators who take advantage of this, and they make short films. And a lot of these are women, and I got some names for your podcast. These are all five Canadians who made Oscar-nominated short films. There's Janet Perlman, Caroline Leaf, Wendy Tilby. I'm going to mispronounce her name. Amanda, I can't even read my writing. Amanda Ferlois, and in 2007, a woman named Toril Cove won the Oscar for her short film, The Danish Poet.
That is a good movie, yeah. I didn't know that was a woman director. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's a good thing. Nobody made a big deal out of the fact she was a woman, right?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
It's a Norwegian name. You can't really tell from the name.
Yeah. There's so much cool stuff coming out of out of that area too, and that's awesome. That one of the best. I mean, that's definitely one of the most recent, most popular ones that I've heard of. It's got a lot of press. That is so cool. I had no idea that that women had such a legacy in alternative animation. That's
Mean, it's like I've seen so many of these like Canadian short films, and they are very. They do focus more on the artistic side, not so much the narrative storytelling. A lot of them are very abstract, and they use, like, they're not, like, traditional forms of animation. Like, some of them, it's animating with sand, or animating with oil paint, or, you know, silhouette puppets. So it's a lot of experimental expression from the independent side of it. And it's like the quote that I gave you earlier. I mean, there's no hierarchy. You have to work your way through.
Yeah,
you can
just
do it on your own.
There's no men holding you down. Yeah. See, I mean that is so cool, and it makes a lot of sense because if you're the type of person that you're kind of trying to get into the system, and the system's not really like, you know, a lot of guys that are talented, welcome with open arms, come on, let's make you awesome, we'll help you out. But with women, you kind of have to,
they gotta find,
especially
their own
traditionally,
way.
back in the 40s and 50s and stuff. And if you don't have anybody to fight against all the time and constantly battling with creative decisions and stuff, that's so cool. I'm definitely gonna have to check out a lot of those animations.
Well, it's interesting because as a society, we do view women as artists very easily, women are artists, and you know,
sensitive,
I'm never
types.
Yeah. Ones who express themselves. Yeah. I mean, I'm never surprised to see female concept artists in the game industry.
Yeah.
Less surprised to see female animators lately, but if I see a female programmer, I am impressed. I'm like, how did you get into that section? You never see it.
Well, in this game developer survey, programmers are represented the least. Hold on, let me see if I can find that number. Programmers,
it's just interesting,
women make up 3%.
In the game industry, especially going back, that's the only thing that was really available. You were either a concept artist or a programmer, and there was actually quite a few women in programming, but one reason I think a lot of the women go into film for art is a lot of people just assume women programmers are these super nerdy, very guy-like type figures, which isn't true, especially now it's not true.
You can be a nerdy programmer, person who has all these technical abilities, but you better do your makeup, you better look hot while you're doing it. That's cool.
Well,
sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
We're probably about ready to wrap up. I mean, do you guys have any links or that to your websites that you want people to check out? I mean, do you guys have anything you want to plug, I guess is the word, or anything like that? Or any other final comments you guys wanted to say, get off your chest before we're done?
I can also point out that this thing also says, as far as producers go, there are a lot of women. There are a lot of women. This also goes for, film and television, too. You see a lot more, women in, the business side of it, producers or,
Management roles.
Management roles. Than you do, as artists represented. But even though they still get paid less.
That's such a bummer. Because, I've definitely been spoiled in all the places that I've worked where I've had really great women animators that are, in positions that are equal, if not higher than me, that I've learned from, and I think it's just ridiculous, in a lot of ways, women should be paid more just because of having to deal with some of this stuff, but, I'm not going to go so far as to say, to push that, but I definitely at least equal,
it's
that's ridiculous.
If you talk to guys in the industry, they will say that it's easier for a girl to get a job. And they always say how hard it is for them to struggle. I'm like, are you sure? I was like, do you think just because we have our female figure that we're going to just walk in the door and that's going to happen?
Bat your eyes, yeah.
And if we do get in the door, it is not easy. I think they treat you a little, harder just to see if you can, manage.
Do you think do you think that kind of toughens you up though, almost in a way, to where it makes
it
you a
does,
better
but
artist?
I don't feel
or
you should have to be able to toughen up. If you have good skills and you went to school and you did everything that you're supposed to, you should just be able to go in and say, here's my stuff, you know, like, you know.
Yeah. Not always have to be on guard and, like, on the defensive of, like, well, you know, like, I've got to, you know, do better or whatever.
I think a lot of guys, by that same token, feel like they have to be on their guard when women are around. Like, they can't make a dirty joke or,
yeah,
you,
know,
like,
oh,
make a
you know, calm it down, there's a girl, there's a female in the room. It's like, I can handle whatever you spew at me.
You know what? I'll make a dirty joke. I don't care. You know, I'll laugh at that stuff. You don't, I mean, they, I, you don't. I mean, I can't speak for everyone. There are some women who are sensitive to that stuff. But I don't think it has so much to do with that they're women, because I've known a lot of men who are very, like, proper, and they have, they're sensitive to, you know, what they consider undignified behavior or crudeness. But I think for the most part, yeah, you don't have to worry, oh, a lady is present. We can't talk about, you know, things that every adult knows about, like sex. We know about sex. You can talk about it.
Especially in an environment like a video game studio or an animation studio where there is...
There's a lot more foul language. People are dressed casually.
Yeah.
You're going to hear... I actually hear some women around here saying some pretty crude things very loudly throughout the day.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon in this...
During dinner, yeah.
Industry. So.
Well... yeah, anybody else have anything, last words to say? Well, thank you guys very much. I appreciate it. This was awesome. There's a lot of really good stuff in here. I definitely am excited to listen back to it and play it for everyone. So.
Everything worked out better than expected.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you guys again.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. Paula had a couple corrections on some of her statistics. It looks like Nina Paley, Sea to Sing the Blues, was not nominated for an Oscar, but it won numerous awards. You can check out the Wikipedia page and see that. The name that she got wrong because she couldn't read her handwriting was Amanda Forbes, and she worked with Wendy Tilby on the short When the Day Breaks in 1999, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed the podcast. The next ones coming up are going to be very good. I've got some really cool, exciting people that I'm interviewing, some people I highly respect, and some Austin animators, as well as some people from around the world. So, Mom, anything you want to wrap up on this particular podcast?
I'm excited that you let me join you today in your podcast, and I just thank everybody for listening to my son.
Well, thank you for doing it. I know you're apprehensive on it, so... Well, all right, we'll see you guys next time. This has been the Alt Animation Podcast. Tune in and subscribe to iTunes and tell your friends about it. All right.
All right, bye.
Thanks. Oh, also, I was going to play a clip I recorded from the new Autodesk Maya presentation. The guy's talking about a really cool new feature. There's a lot of cool things in the new Maya for animation, but one in particular is the new Auto Tangent. So I'm going to play that for you guys. I'm putting it at the end, so if you guys aren't interested in that, you can turn it off. There won't be anything after this. All right, bye.
So, a couple other things to point out in here. We have a new curve type. So the new curve type in Maya kind of alleviates some of the problems that we've had in the past with our old curve types. So we've had this traditional spline tangent type. And what this does basically is, if I were to go in here, and actually let's just insert a key. I'm not sure why that error is showing up, but it's bugging me. Let's get rid of that. All right, so I'm going to go in here and insert a key. I'll just drop down a key right there. So what you'll notice is that when I basically pull this key kind of in closer to the neighboring key, that I get this little kind of bump in between them. It's a little bit hard to see, but actually maybe I can frame it a little closer there. It's about as close as I can get. But you can kind of see there, it's basically creating a little bump, kind of a little hiccup between those two. And sometimes that's more dramatic than others. Actually here you can kind of see it too. It kind of overshoots the key. So what we've done is we've added something called autotangent, which basically is a combination of different types of keys. So autotangent basically gives you kind of a smart curve, essentially. And it basically will dynamically update the tangents based on the preceding and succeeding keys. So if I can actually isolate that key. If I grab this guy and I pull him out and kind of pull him down, and actually let me turn the tangents back on so you can actually see what this is doing. Actually, let me just turn on selected. There we go. So now as I move this up, you can see it automatically aligns to the succeeding and preceding key. And if I get it within a certain range, it'll automatically and dynamically start to flatten out. Now we had something called a clamped key at one point, but it was really rigid and it would always kind of snap into place. Ah, thank you. That's a huge glass of water. Thank you. I don't think I'll finish all of that on mine. So at any rate, you get the basic idea. So if you're not an animator, you may not appreciate this. If you are an animator, this is actually a really, really slick addition. I mean, it's one of those things that you're just confronted with on a daily basis. You literally are always dealing with keys. So just the ability to quickly and easily go in there and just kind of flatten out a key just by adjusting it slightly, and then getting kind of a variable flatten between those different points is a really, really nice mechanism. This is another thing that was unified also between Maya and Motion Builder. So we have this exact key type in Motion Builder now, and they transfer back and forth.